Now at our last meeting, we were still talking about the fourth century. And until you get to the 16th century, there is no century in Christian history that is anywhere near as important for church history as the fourth century. Now when I say for church history, of course I'm excluding gospel history or apostolic history. I'm excluding the material in the Bible, which makes the first century naturally far more important than any other. But aside from what's in the Bible, we know very little about the first century. The second and third century could conceivably have been of an importance, perhaps two-thirds as great as the fourth, I don't know. But what we know about them is not a fifth what we know about the fourth century. So as far as church history is concerned, they simply can't be put in the same category. Now we do not know more than half as much about the fifth century as we do about the fourth. And 9/10 of what we know about the fifth century comes from its first 60 years. After that, the Dark Ages. After that, we're in the Dark Ages until we get to the Reformation, the 16th century. So that this is a tremendously important century, and we have to be very selective in dealing with it, in picking the things which are of most importance to give, to deal with in a course like this. And I mentioned at the end of the last hour that there were two individuals with whom we ought to become somewhat acquainted. Now, you might say there are three, but the third of, I mean, in addition to those we've already looked at, but the third of these individuals is one of whom we'll have to say so much that I'll give him a separate head. But there were two men whom I was going to give this present heading M to, Ambrose and Chrysostom. One of them from the west, one of them from the east, neither of them a man who directly influenced the course of church history anywhere nearly as much as did Athanasius or Jerome, but both of them among the outstanding characters in the whole of the history of the Christian church. And therefore, I feel that every Christian worker, every Christian student ought to be familiar with these two very great men. Now, the first of them we have already mentioned. He was Ambrose of Milan. And we mentioned small a, we mentioned his background, how he came from a family that had been active in Roman political affairs, and how he was sent to Milan in order to be governor of that whole area. And when he went there, the superior who sent him, recommending that he deal righteously and justly with the people and try to keep them happy and contented, said, "Go, not as ruler, but as bishop." And the man spoke more truly than he ever dreamed. Because we looked already in a previous connection at the fact, which I mentioned, a small b, becomes Bishop of Milan. And we noticed how when the people of Milan, the Christians of Milan, were gathered to get their new bishop, and a few wanted an Arian bishop, and they were making quite a bit of protest and trouble and noise about their insistence on having an Arian bishop, and while the majority wanted an Orthodox bishop, they could not agree on a man whom they thought was of outstanding ability, and they were greater in number but less great in vociferousness than those who were trying to get an Arian bishop, and it looked as if there might be disturbances, and so Governor Ambrose was on hand with a group of soldiers in order to keep order. And some child said, "Make Ambrose bishop." And somebody caught it up, and others repeated it, and pretty soon it went all through the crowd, "Make Ambrose bishop," and everybody felt that Ambrose would be very fair, very true, entirely Christian in his administration of this important position of the leadership of the Church of Milan, and so with just about complete unanimity, the people called out, "Ambrose, Ambrose, let's have Ambrose for bishop," and here he was the Roman governor. And Ambrose said, "I couldn't be bishop. I'm not worthy to be a bishop. I'm a political man. I'm a governor." But the people said, the people have unanimously called upon you. They said, "God is very clearly calling you to this important position. You should take it." And Ambrose
after a little consideration, he said, all right, he said, my whole life will be changed. I will devote it to Christian service. He took his estate and gave a certain amount of it for an endowment for his sister to take care of her. The rest of it he sold and gave it to the poor. He gave up his royal robes, all the signs of his of luxury of the office of governor, and became the Bishop of Milan. He set himself to work studying. He never became a great Christian scholar, but he was a man who was determined to stand for the Scripture and to take its great teachings and to present them forcibly to the people. And so Ambrose, as bishop, left a mark on Milan which remains to this day. The churches of Milan have different service than the churches of other parts of the world, because he established a particular order of service which pleased the people so greatly they never would consider a change in all the centuries that have passed since. And Ambrose was an administrator, primarily. He was a great administrator, but he gave much attention to his preaching, much attention to his pastoral work, and he left an ineffaceable mark upon the future life of this great city of Milan. Now, in his course of time as a bishop during this, the Arian controversy was in its last portion, and he played an active part of it. As you know, the Arians had been most successful in the East. In the West, the Arians had had comparatively few followers, except during the 10 years when Constantius was in complete control of the West, of the whole empire. And during that time, there had been great efforts made to change the West into a strong Arian viewpoint, but it had been strongly resisted, and it was only for about 10 years. Most of the leaders in the West held to the Nicene view right through. And so they never had near the difficulties with Arianism in the West as they had in the East, but they had a certain number. As I have, in giving you the names of the Roman emperors, I have laid some stress on Valens, who was governor, who was emperor of the East, because of the fact that Valens made such an effort to follow on in the steps of Constantius and to establish Arianism in the East, and also because he held unrivaled control of the East during the period from 265 to his death in 278. But during this period and the succeeding 10 years, there were several emperors in the West. It was Valens' brother who had become emperor, and he had made Valens emperor in the East while himself keeping the West. I'm not going to bother you much with details about him, because for one thing, he didn't live very long after he became an emperor, and for another thing, he threw his influence in favor of the Orthodox Jews, which was already pretty dominant in the West. But then he, Valentinian I, was succeeded at his death by his two sons, one of whom was in his teens, and the other one was an infant in arms. And the two of them ruled jointly, which meant that the mother of the infant had a very large voice in the control, and she had strong Arian sympathies. So this made a certain amount of difficulty in the West. I'm not going into these details. They had a time when a usurper seized Britain and France and held them for a time. I'm only mentioning them in reference to Ambrose, that Ambrose was not bishop in an easy time when there were no problems. There were very severe problems. There were problems with political upheavals and turmoil. The man was in his teens when he became emperor, who ruled for about 10 years and was very friendly to Ambrose, was eventually assassinated, and the usurper took over. And Ambrose was able, in these difficult times, to do much to help preserve order, or at least to keep the disorder much less than it would have been in the West. But the Queen Mother wanted to have an Arian church in Milan, and he very strongly opposed this and ran into real difficulties with her.
And then there came the time when mercenary troops were brought in. This was one trouble with the end of the Roman Empire. People give causes for the downfall of the Roman Empire, but one cause, which is, I believe, too much overlooked, is that the Roman Empire, in its latter days, depended too much on mercenary soldiers. Mercenary soldiers are very helpful in maintaining order in a country, and in the Roman Empire, they had mercenary soldiers right from the beginning of the empire. Right from the time of Julius Caesar or before, there were barbarians from outside of the empire who were allowed to come in and to enter the army. And so there was a large Germanic portion to the empire, to the army in the very earliest days of the empire. But the majority of the army was always made up of natives, until you get to the 4th century. And they were constantly bringing in these people from outside who would be soldiers under authority, and if they proved to be able, would rise to positions of importance, and then their families would become Roman citizens and their descendants became part of the Roman Empire. So a very large part of the population of the Roman Empire in the 4th century was of Germanic background and Germanic stock, even though fully Romanized, speaking Latin, and just as developed in Latin culture and Latin outlook as were the people with long Roman ancestry. But in the 4th century, with the great difficulty with the barbarian troops outside, and with the greater difficulty of enlisting native troops, the armies became more and more made up of foreigners brought in to be in the army, and the time came when these armies naturally got almost complete control, at least in the West. So it was quite easy for when a great group of barbarians came in for the whole area to go over to them. But there was a large army contingent settled in Milan, and they felt they were Arians. Ulfilas, you remember, was the great missionary to the Goths, and he had brought them Christian teaching, he had translated the Bible. Unfortunately, he had simply taken over the Arian teaching in which he was brought up, and these people felt themselves to have an entirely different outlook from the Orthodox people of the empire as a whole, and they wanted Arian preaching. And so it was said, you must have a church for these soldiers where they will get Arian preaching. And Ambrose felt that it would be wicked to have this Arian preaching presented in any one of the churches in Milan. And he resolutely resisted the efforts of the Queen Mother to insist that one church be devoted to Arian preaching and have an Arian presbyter in charge of it. And at one time, the conflict became so great between them that a large army contingent was sent into the city, and Ambrose went into the large church which had been planned to give over to the Arians, and he went in there and simply stayed there. He and a group of his men simply stayed in that church to hold it for the Orthodox people. And there was a large army contingent outside, and the people were afraid that Ambrose would be seized and carried away, and without his leadership, they didn't know what would happen. And so there was a time of tremendous anxiety and excitement. And during this time, Ambrose said that he had a vision. He said he had a vision that under one of the other churches, there were buried the bones of two martyrs from a century before. And that these martyrs had been buried there and their grave absolutely forgotten, but that this was an evidence, this dream he'd had was evidence that God was with them and would protect them. And so they went to the church and dug there, and there they found some bones which were bones of giants, they said, almost superhuman in size, of two men. And they brought these bones out and declared that here were the relics of these two great martyrs, and it made such an excitement in the city that the king had to give up her efforts to establish Arianism. Now, what exactly the full story is, we don't know. But this is the story as it was told by Ambrose's admirer. At any rate, he completely won out
against the efforts of the Queen Mother to force that certain amount of Arian preaching be permitted in Milan. Ambrose, his sermons are not outstanding, but they are good, solid presentations of Christian truth. And they had a great effect upon the people who heard that. He entered into correspondence with the leaders of the church in other sections. He was helpful to them in his advice and his suggestions. He took a great interest in music, and he said to have written a good many hymns, some of which had a great vogue in the church for many years. There is a St. Augustine, of whom you'll hear later, who is perhaps the greatest thinker in the ancient church. There certainly is no man in the ancient church outside the New Testament who is as famous in Christian history as St. Augustine. St. Augustine came to Christianity in Milan after hearing a series of sermons by St. Ambrose, and a myth grew up that during this time of great difficulty with the Queen Mother and with these troops around them, that during this time, Ambrose composed a Te Deum, a song of praise to God, which was very greatly used during the Middle Ages, and that he and Augustine sang it antiphonally in the church. Now, of course, all we know is that Augustine was there and was greatly influenced by Ambrose, and most scholars think that the attributing the Te Deum to them and saying they sang it jointly is purely a legend of later times. But it's interesting, it's connecting up these two great men. Yes? Valentinian first was the emperor. I'm not asking any of you to remember these details of the Western Empire, but just to satisfy curiosity, Valentinian first became emperor, and he took his, made his brother Valens associate with himself as emperor of the East. But before many years, Valentinian first died, and he was succeeded by his oldest son, Gratian, who was in his teens, and the little baby who was Valentinian II. And Gratian was assassinated, and it was after that that the mother of the little boy tried to introduce the Arianism. Just before that, the usurper in Gaul who had assassinated Gratian was going to march into Italy and seize Italy too, and Ambrose had gone up alone to meet him and persuade him not to come. So the Queen Mother owed a great deal to him. But in this crisis, he forgot all about that. Well, now these troubles came to an end by about 390, because when Valens died in the East, Gratian, who was now ruling at that time in the West, had the great wisdom in this terrible crisis when Valens had been killed by the oncoming of the Goths at the Battle of Adrianople. He had the great wisdom to pick a man living in exile in Spain, a Spaniard whose father had been killed due to some jealousy on the part of Gratian's father, but who was a very able fellow, very clearly. Gratian had the wisdom to forget the old animosity and to turn to Theodosius in Spain and ask him to take over the Eastern Empire and take the place of Valens. And Theodosius, in 378, went to the east and made a peace with the Goths and made the frontier solid, managed to establish things solidly there. He was the one, you remember, through whom who was helpful in establishing the end of Arianism in the east. But it was not simply a matter done by force, because the great efforts of Athanasius and Basil and the two Gregories had convinced thinking people in the East that Arianism was wrong. And so when Theodosius used imperial force in connection with it, it had only an effect on the mass of unthinking people. The leadership had pretty well become convinced, except for very few, that Arianism was wrong. And it was Theodosius who called the second great general council the Council of Constantinople. And it was Theodosius who made heathenism illegal. Constantine, you remember, had only made Christianity legal. He had been taller, but Theodosius was not particularly tall. But Theodosius was a very able man, an able general, an able administrator, one of the great emperors in the history of the Roman Empire. And Theodosius, however, had a very hot temper. And there was a time when, in Thessalonica, the leader of the leading gladiator in Thessalonica committed an immorality of a type which the people of the Roman Empire, who were rather degenerate morally on the whole, thought of as very little. But the people, the northern barbarians, as they called them, were much stricter on this sort of thing. Though they were given to drunkenness far more than the people of the Roman Empire, they, on moral matters, were far more straight and solid than the people of the Roman Empire, and it was a type of immorality which disgusted the mercenary soldiers to such an extent that they seized this gladiator and killed him. And this aroused the anger of the mob in Thessalonica to such an extent that they made an attack upon the mercenary soldiers and killed their leader and a number of their officers. And Theodosius, when he heard of that, completely lost his temper. And he sent in a group of other mercenary soldiers in addition and told them that they were free to revenge their fellow officers and these fellow officers who had been killed by the mob in Thessalonica. And as a result, according to one record, 25,000 Thessalonian people lost their lives in a general massacre by these mercenary soldiers. Well, we wouldn't go into the details of that in this class, except for its effect upon Ambrose. Ambrose was horrified when he heard. And some little time after this occurred, this, as you know, happened way over in Greece, it's a long way from Milan. But some little time after he heard it, they were having the great service of Christmas, and there the people came up forward one by one to partake of the communion. And someone told him, he said, Ambrose, they said, the emperor has joined the line. He is there in the line, he's coming to the service, he's going to partake of communion. And Ambrose said to one of his presbyters, he said, here, you carry on with the communion for a few minutes, I'll be back. And he went back and he faced the emperor in the line and he said, your hands are blood. Your hands are covered with the blood of the helpless people of Thessalonica whom you allowed your troops to massacre. He said, a man with bloody hands can never take part in the communion in my church. And many an emperor would have killed the man on the spot who talked to him that way. But Theodosius, despite his hot temper, was a man of very high character and a man who realized the greatness of Ambrose very thoroughly. And Theodosius publicly professed his repentance for his hot temper and for the results of it and publicly asked forgiveness before Ambrose permitted him to come into the church. And historians differ in their judgment on this, because as we look forward to future history, we see on the one hand Ambrose standing for righteousness and Theodosius having done a terrible thing, being rebuked when the man's life was at stake. A man who would rebuke an emperor in this way, we see him rebuked and we see him bowing before the moral grandeur of Ambrose and submitting. But on the other hand, some say, here is the background of precedence for church leaders in the Middle Ages, making kings and emperors bow to their authority and treating them with arrogance. And thus, it's pretty hard to foresee the results of many an act. If you're ever an administration of any sort of an organization, you will have to think in most everything you do, not merely of the immediate effect, but also of the precedence which it may create. And that can be, I never like to give anybody a special favor unless I'm ready to give the same favor to anybody else, not merely who has the same reason to reasonably ask for it as that one, but the same anybody else who would ask for it if he knew that I would be willing to grant it. And so I feel one has to, in administering anything, one has to be very impartial and fair in all such matters and enforce things uniformly. But you can't think very well of what precedence your actions are going to have in the centuries ahead. I don't think it's proper to blame Ambrose for this. It shows the greatness of the man, the greatness of his influence and his ability here in Milan. But now we go on to a very different man. A very different man, and a man whose fate was very, very different from that of Ambrose. Number two is Chrysostom. And Chrysostom is not his name. His name was John. I don't know whether he had any other name. Everybody called him John. But eventually people called him John Chrysostom. And Chrysostom, as all of you know, of course, is a Greek word composed of Chrysos, gold, and stoma, mouth. John the Golden Mouth. And he is known historically as Chrysostom, the name people applied to him because of his marvelous ability as a speaker. But Chrysostom, the small a here, Chrysostom came from a well-to-do Christian family in Antioch. And here we have looked at a man in the west, now we look at a man in the east. Antioch was the second largest city in the empire. It was a great city of luxury, of vice, of splendor, of everything that characterizes a great city in most eras of the world history. It was second only to Rome in all these regards. And during this century, as we've already noticed, the Christians throughout the empire were reacting very strongly to the vice, the licentiousness, the luxury of the empire as a whole, and were going to the opposite extreme and feeling that they would honor God by going out into the wilderness and living in absolute penury, simply devoting themselves to study of the word and to prayer by completely withdrawing from the world. Well, John Chrysostom, John as he was known as a young man, had a very fine education, trained in Athens under the best rhetoricians, very excellent and outstanding education, but he felt that he wanted his life to come entirely for the Lord, and he felt that the way that he would like to do it was to withdraw completely from the world, to give up any of the luxuries or even the pleasures of ordinary human life. And so he came back to Antioch, and then he went out into the Syrian desert. And for 10 years he lived as a hermit out in the desert. But he was a man of education, and he had the Bible. And so he studied the scripture extensively. And his 10 years were by no means 10 years of vegetation. They were 10 years of eating very little, 10 years of sleeping very little, 10 years of great privation and mistreatment of his body, which weakened him, and he felt the effects of it all the rest of his life. But they were years of great progress in the knowledge of the Bible and in his understanding of how to express Christian truth. And then, after 10 years, he was decided that the Lord would have him to enter into the life of the people directly. And that, of course, monastic points the example of Paul, who went out into the desert in Arabia for 3 years. But Paul, during those 3 years, was studying the scripture and praying and getting a hold on Christian truth, and during most of the rest of his life, he was actively engaged in presenting Christian truth and taking an active part in the work. Well, this is what Chrysostom did. He kept up his life of asceticism. He kept away from most of the pleasures of life the rest of his life, pleasures of the flesh of every type, those which, not only those which we look upon as sinful, but those which we look upon as natural. But he came into Antioch and began to preach and was ordained there as a presbyter. And soon people recognized that he was a very, very able preacher. He had a marvelous gift of expression. And for 18 years, he was a preacher in Antioch. And there have been preserved from him dozens of sermons on the book of Genesis and on the Psalms, on Isaiah, on the book of John, on various, dozens on each one of these. His sermons were copied down and preserved, and many of them thrill you even today as you read them with his marvelous pictorial gifts and his ability to drive things home to people's minds and hearts. But we look on to see the statue. Small c, the statue. Theodosius, as the ruler of the Roman Empire, was ruling in difficult days. The barbarians were pushing on the border. And there may have been those then who said, why should we try to police the world? If they want to come in, let them come. Well, if they had, probably the Dark Ages would have begun 50 years earlier than they did. But most of the people were content to have the emperor protect them, but they didn't like to pay the heavy taxes that were necessary to protect them. And they probably would have made still more fuss if he had drafted their sons to help in the protection, but he didn't do that. Largely, he used mercenary troops, which in the end proved to be a mistake. But the taxes were heavy. The conditions were difficult of life in the empire during this period. There were a number of times when the barbarians did break through and when things were very serious for a time, and there were a number of times when a usurper seized power in a certain area and when there was a certain amount of civil war within the empire, though this was usually simply different groups of mercenaries fighting under the direction of officials of the empire who stood on one side or the other. But Theodosius had very tough problems on his hands, and occasionally he lost his head. He would occasionally lose his temper, as he had there in Thessalonica. And in Antioch, there was an arousement of feeling against some of the things that the emperor had done at one time, and the people, the mob, broke into the city hall in Antioch, and who was composed this mob? Some people say there were a lot of outsiders, a lot of agitators come in from outside. Others say there were a lot of the dregs of society in the mob. How many of the better citizens of any took part in it, we don't know. But it was the procedure of the Roman Empire to hold the whole city responsible for anything that happened. And as a matter of fact, later on, a number of the leading citizens of Antioch were very severely punished. When nobody said they had any part in the riot, but it was said that they should have foreseen the riot and taken measures to prevent it. And they were very severely punished for that. But this mob broke into the city hall, took the statue of Theodosius, hurled it to the floor, broke it in pieces. What was perhaps worse, took the statue of his beloved wife who had died only a short time before, and threw that to the floor and broke it in pieces. Did the same with the other statues of leaders of the empire, and caused considerable destruction and turmoil in the city. But the thing that got the most attention was what they had done to these statues. And then the people of Antioch, when the riot was over, realized that Theodosius would not take a thing like that without retribution. And they knew what he had occasionally done in other places where there had been uprisings, and they wondered if anybody in Antioch would be allowed to live. And the governor of Antioch started off for Constantinople to let the emperor know exactly what had happened. But the bishop of Antioch, the elderly bishop of Antioch, set out also, and he managed to go faster than the governor did and to get to Theodosius first. But of course, nobody knew that he would. Nobody knew what the result would be. The people of the city were absolutely terrified as they thought of the terrible vengeance that Theodosius would probably bring upon them. And during this time, John gave a series of messages which they call On the Statue. And they were messages which were given to the people at this time, not in any sense defending them for the terrible things that had been done, but calling upon them to turn away from sin, to turn to the Lord, to look to Him, and calling upon the people who believed in the Lord to realize that He controls all things and that they could put their trust in Him and could know that if they truly trusted Him, whatever happened would be in accordance with His will and would be for their good. And so He gave a great series of messages at this time called On the Statutes, which made the people of Antioch love Him tremendously and spread the name of Chrysostom throughout the whole Roman world. Well, the bishop got to Theodosius ahead of the governor, and he presented pleas for the people of the city. The governor then got there and told him what all had happened. Theodosius perhaps took it more calmly than he would have if he hadn't been prepared beforehand, but it was a serious thing which had to be dealt with strongly and vigorously, but perhaps not as harshly as it might have been otherwise. And so word came back that the city as a whole was to be spared. For all they knew, he might tear down the whole city and make it just a ruin when the city did a thing like that. But the city was spared. Many of the leading citizens were imprisoned and deprived of their goods for not having foreseen the riots and taken measures to prevent it. There were individuals punished. But the great bulk of the people of the city felt that they had been spared from a terrible fate which might have been theirs, and all of them looked on Chrysostom as the one who had been he was a great hero to the city, and to the Christians, he was one who had given them consolation and blessing and turned their eyes to the Lord, and they were determined that nothing would ever deprive them of Chrysostom. Now, D, Bishop of Constantinople, 398. I believe it's 395, sometime between 395 and 398, Theodosius died. And Theodosius was succeeded by his two unworthy sons, one of whom took the eastern half and the other took the western half. Now, we've had the empire divided before, but this is the final division of the Roman Empire. Never again was the Roman Empire under one head. It had been under Theodosius for a brief time. But now, never again was the Roman Empire under one head. It was hereafter always two sections, the eastern and the western section. And one of his sons took the east and one took the west. And it is historians remark that it is a rather strange thing, that Theodosius' father was a very, very able general, an able man, but who had aroused the ire of Valentinian I, who had him killed. Theodosius himself was a very able emperor, a very great general, but of his male descendants, no one of them seems to have inherited any of his great abilities. We do have two or three cases in the next century where women who were descended from Theodosius were very able women and had a good bit of Theodosius' ability. But his two sons who took over inherited his power. He had established pretty much stability in the empire. They enjoyed the luxuries that could be theirs and didn't pay much attention to the great problems that they needed to face. Left the maintenance of law and order largely in the hands of the mercenaries. And there were some able men among these mercenaries who did some very good work. But particularly the emperor in the east, he's not of 1/100th the importance as a man of his father Theodosius. I don't care if you forget Arcadius' name altogether. But if you want it, it's A-R-C-A-D-I-U-S. Arcadius in the east was a rather of a weak man who was largely under the influence of certain eunuchs in the court for a time, and then one of them got him to marry a Gothic woman, the daughter of one of the Gothic generals, and he was greatly under her influence for a number of years. He didn't live long. He died about 408. But during these years, the bishop of Constantinople died, and the people of Constantinople wanted to have the greatest preacher in the Roman Empire for the Bishop of Constantinople. And so these people in the court said, won't it be an ornament to the city of Constantinople to have the greatest preacher in the empire for our bishop? They said, let's get Chrysostom from Antioch. And rumors came to the people of Antioch, and they said, my, we'll never give up John. He's got to stay here. And they would never consent to have John leave Antioch. But the court group in Constantinople made up a scheme. They got an official in Antioch to go to Chrysostom and say, there's a church out in the suburbs here that has particular problems, and if you could come and give them a message, we think it would be very helpful, and to persuade him to get outside the city walls that way. And when they got him outside the city walls, they seized him and put him in an imperial carriage and drove him 700 miles to Constantinople. And when they got him to Constantinople, they declared that John Chrysostom was to be the bishop of Constantinople. And so he became bishop in Constantinople in 398, a very great ornament for Constantinople, soon greatly beloved of the people of Constantinople as a whole. His sermons were attended by tremendous groups of people, and he had many great admirers. He was absolutely selfless in his attitude, devoted to the Word of God, but he was unwilling to compromise with any form of evil, whatever. And so naturally we have small e trouble with the court. And here we have the great difference that came between the Eastern and the Western Church. In the West, the government was largely centered in Milan or some other city in Italy. Rome was no longer the capital, but Rome was still the greatest city and contained the wealthiest and most prominent people, but it was no longer the capital. But in the East, Constantinople was the capital and the emperor was there. And so the bishop of Constantinople was very much under the shadow of the imperial power. While the bishop of Rome had no civil functionary who could compare in importance or in continuance in office with the power of the bishop of Rome. And the bishop of Rome came to exert an influence in his area much greater than the bishop of Constantinople usually could influence, because he was under the shadow of the court. And now he had troubles with the court, because whenever he heard of scandals, he heard of bribery, he heard of the great luxury of the people who were living and spending tremendous sums on their own pleasures, and he preached. He didn't hesitate to preach in the strongest language against it, and that irritated them very greatly. And the people who had thought it would be a wonderful thing to bring him to Constantinople began to decide that it'd be a still better thing to get rid of. And so he preached great sermons there against the hypocrisies and the luxuries and the sins of the court, and the members of the court began to plot how to get rid of it. And they found that at this time the Bishop of Alexandria was a man who was very easy to get into their plans, because he had had ideas of who he wanted to be Bishop of Constantinople when they had gotten this man, and he was quite ready to fall in with their plans. And so, S is exile and death. Exile and death. When Chrysostom was 60 years of age, he was not in good health, his body was greatly worn down, largely as a result of the terrible asceticism of those 10 years, but he kept up pretty much ascetic practices ever since. He, of course, he worked very hard and prepared his sermons and studied the Bible with a tremendous amount of time and energy and effort. They gave orders that he should be exiled from the city, and people gathered around him. And they said, no, we will protect you to the death. We will not submit to this. There were great crowds of people around and the leaders in the church, but Chrysostom said no. He said the authority is in the hands of the civil authorities here. They have given these orders. I must submit to them. So he walked out and joined these people, and they took him a few miles away. From there, he corresponded with his friends and still made his position very clear, and a great earthquake came. And the empress felt that this was perhaps a punishment for sending Chrysostom away, and she sent and begged him to come back. And so they brought him back, and the people rejoiced to have him back, and he was particularly called to his attention some of her practices. And he began one sermon with the words something like this: Herodias dances, she demands the head of John the Baptist on a platter, she is determined to destroy everything that interferes with her. And he went on talking about the general luxuries of the court, and people said he was talking about the empress. Some later said he never actually used those words in the sermon. But if he didn't, a great many people quoted them as if he had, and he may have said something somewhat similar. At any rate, Chrysostom had absolutely no tact. He never did that. Where he saw anything wrong, he spoke out against it, unhesitating. And, of course, his oratory was so great that people could utterly disagree with him and yet could be completely thrilled with the way he was able to speak and with the way he was able to present almost anything. But they... Again, he was ordered into exile. They got the Bishop of Alexandria to organize a council and make a declaration that he should be removed from the bishopric of Constantinople. They took him away, a few miles away, and he was corresponding with friends, and there were those who were demanding he be brought back, and someone persuaded the emperor to give orders that he should be sent into exile to a place way up by the Black Sea. And two soldiers were ordered to take him there, and they were to get a reward if they got him there safely, and perhaps a greater reward if he died on the way. At any rate, they made him walk hundreds of miles, treated him very harshly, and it was a very severe, difficult weather, and on the way he died. And the Bishop of Rome said, the way that Constantinople has treated this great godly man is utterly wrong. We break off all communication with them. And we declare that until they repent of this sin, we will not have relations with the Church of Constantinople. And Constantinople, they got another man carried on. But 20 years later, the grandson of Theodosius I brought back the bones of Theodosius, put him, buried them with great pomp in Constantinople. They publicly asked forgiveness for what they had done, and Rome again came into relationship with them. But the power of the emperor over the church was pretty solid as far as the East was concerned. Now we'll have to continue there tomorrow.